In the UK, the government talks about Clean Power 2030, its action plan to ensure that 95% of all electricity generated comes from clean sources by, you guessed it, the year 2030. But if you want to connect a new solar farm to the grid, if you're already not in the queue, no chance. That's the contradiction running through Britain's energy transition. The technology exists, the money is waiting, the ambition is there. What's missing is the permission to plug it all in. Across the country, hundreds of projects, wind farms, batteries, data centres, are stuck in the queue, waiting for a connection. Developers are waiting on timelines. Increasingly, demand can't electrify, and the grid queue is so oversupplied that new applications have stopped altogether. This is the bottleneck behind the transition, the quiet, bureaucratic crisis that decides whether Britain's clean energy revolution can actually happen, because the ambition isn't the problem anymore, capacity is. The system's full, the rules are complicated, and the wires that move power across the country are based upon investments from decades ago. Our guest today, Charles, sees the bottleneck up close. He is the managing director at Eclipse Power Solutions. Eclipse helps developers and large consumers navigate the queue and secure connections. When the main network operators can't deliver, Eclipse builds alternative private networks through its sister organization, Eclipse Power Networks. Charles spends his days decoding ever-changing connection rules, unblocking projects, and explaining why plugging something in has become one of the hardest parts of building clean energy. We talk about what's really slowing Britain down, why connection reform is harder than it sounds, how new private networks are emerging as a workaround, and what it will take for Clean Power 2030 to move from a slogan to something we can actually switch on, even if that means clean reality in the 2030s. So, welcome back to Transmission. Today, the bottleneck that defines Britain's clean energy transition, and what it might take to plug the future in. Hello, Charles, and welcome to Transmission.
Hi, Ed. It's great to be here. Nice to be this side of the screen for a change.
Very good, very good. And as ever, let's get started. Could you introduce yourself, and also could you introduce Eclipse Power?
Certainly. So my name's Charles. I am managing director of Eclipse Power Solutions, which is one of the business units that we have within Eclipse Power Group. Most people know Eclipse as an IDNO. So we hold a distribution license to own, adopt and operate distribution systems in England and Wales up to 132 kV and 33 in Scotland. That's been our core business, a large focus on what we call large power. So batteries, renewable generation, data centers, given that we don't have a gas or water license like a lot of other IDNOs. So that's sort of been our position in the market, if you like. A couple of years ago, we set up Eclipse Power Solutions, which is a grid consultancy, helping people get connected to the grid and hopefully making things a bit smoother and easier. And then finally, last January, I believe it was, we launched Eclipse Power Optimize, which is a company that can own, build, invest and operate private networks for behind the meter solutions. And that was a sort of response to our transmission license application back in 2022, which unfortunately didn't progress. But that is also something we're still actively considering.
Okay, very good. And we will definitely come on to private wires because they are a hot topic in the space. Yep. But I'd just like to ask another question on IDNOs. Sure. So like, what exactly is that? For the person on the street, you know, do they know what an IDNO is?
Probably not, but the majority of connections now are going to IDNOs, so they're becoming more well known. So you think of your typical regional DNO, you know, UK Power Networks, NGED.
Just DNO, very quickly, what is a DNO?
Distribution Network Operator. So they operate the local electricity infrastructure that feeds your, you know, homes and businesses, separate from the sort of the motorway network, if you like, which is a national transmission system. This is the sort of A roads and B roads. They traditionally were monopoly businesses, but sometime in the early 2000s, it was opened up to competition. So IDNOs hold exactly the same license from Ofgem as a DNO, but they're not restricted to a geographic area, whereas, you know, regional DNOs are. IDNOs can adopt what's called contestable works, which are essentially the new assets that you have to build between your site. So you might have a field that you want to build a housing estate or a solar farm on. The existing grid might be 5 kilometers away. You've got to build a new bit of cable between. You can either give that to the DNO or you can give it to an IDNO. IDNOs, we like to think, are more flexible and competitive. We're not beholden to a strict, rigid set of engineering standards like the DNOs are, which makes sense because they've got tens of thousands of assets. We can take an engineering view on things and hopefully do things a bit cheaper. And we're also able to pay what's called an asset value on adoption. So we can pay you money to connect, to adopt the asset, whereas a DNO would adopt it for a token sum of a pound.
Okay. Tell me more about that asset value, that final stage. How does that work?
So you would approach an IDNO for an asset value offer based on your grid connection. Essentially, the IDNO makes a regulated revenue off DUOS, which is distribution use of system charge. So that's essentially a toll booth charge for using the grid. We all have an element of that in our electricity bills. That's regulated by Ofgem, so it's set at a certain level. The IDNO will look at what they could earn on that connection. They'll give away essentially an element of that as a sweetener up front. And the reason why our investor likes that, our investor is Octopus, they basically get a regulated rate of return on that asset for 40 to 100 years.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. And I think it will help people just understand that there are some parts of the networks which are very much standard, but there are also different ways of running network connections. And I think we're going to dive into a lot of this over
it's basically the last mile.
Yes. Yeah, the last mile is a great way of doing it, as is your other analogy around sort of motorways being the transmission network and the sort of B roads going into the distribution network. Now, let's sort of take a step back from the sort of IDNO process and let's talk about something which has been running for a few years now, which is connections reform.
Yeah.
We've had a bit of a roller coaster ride in the last year. What's the latest state of play and how do developers stay ready to go?
It's the million-dollar question. I sometimes say to people, I've had all the answers. I wouldn't be doing this job. I'd probably be on sunning myself on a Caribbean island somewhere. Essentially, connections reform, I think it was started being talked about back end of 2022. I think that was the first meeting I went to. Essentially, as most people know, the sort of unregulated market that we had just meant that the queue was huge and we had far more in the queue than we could ever feasibly need for our power needs in terms of generation. So something had to be done, to reduce that queue because the network operators couldn't see the wood for the trees. They didn't know what was a good investment, how to plan their networks. We moved from a first come, first served approach to a first ready, first connected. The definition of readiness was having your land rights signed up. That is probably quite a low bar. And at the time it was like, oh, we can't be having planning as a condition. We can't be deciding to prioritize certain projects over others. Very quickly progressed to realize that that wasn't going to have the desired effect on the queue. So that was then applied retrospectively to the existing queue. It was then realized that wasn't going to have a desired effect. and then Labour government came in 2024 and wrote the Clean Power 2030 Action Plan, which basically gave targets for different technology types at different voltages around the UK, Great Britain, to meet Clean Power 2030, which is a 95% renewable grid. That effectively assigned quotas per technology per area. So then we move to a first ready, first needed, first connected. And the way the queue is ordered is you get your kind of ticket to join the queue once you've got your land rights. That's your gate two readiness. And then depending on whether you have planning permission or not already, that gives you a priority in the queue. And then depending whether you fit within these regional technology quotas, then decides whether you get to remain in the queue or whether you get given a gate one offer, which is worthless.
Okay, and let's not go into too much of the technical detail around the specifics of the gate one, gate two, but just in terms of the latest state of play. So what is the next thing that's going to happen? Because from where I sit, I don't spend all day looking at connections reform, but we have projects that sort of get protected in 2026 and 2027, and yet some of those projects don't yet know whether they're going to get a connection. From the outside looking in, that seems almost ludicrous.
Yes, I would agree. I think it's quite easy to sort of forget that people aren't in this detail all the time. We have seen some delays. There was issues with NESO's portal for the transmission projects that caused a lot of delays and concern in the industry with data issues. So that meant the evidence submission window is open for a couple more months. The original program of works to get offers out was quite ambitious, and it relied on there being a potentially low level of failures from the detailed checks. The DNOs for the distribution projects found they had quite a high level of failures initially, but they worked with customers to get that back down to zero. So NESO thought, well, not zero, but close enough. So NESO thought, we don't want to be kicking people out of the queue unnecessarily. Let's have a bit more time, do more checks to help customers get the right outcome. So it will benefit customers I believe, in the long run. But you're exactly right. We have projects which are protected because they've got planning and they've got a near-term connection date. So they've been given protection, so they have investment certainty. Yet the opposite is happening because they're then being told we can't have an offer until January, I think, if you're a transmission connection, or maybe March if you're a DNO connection.
Yeah.
And I think confidence at the moment is quite low in the entire process. So while developers have got the protection, they don't trust it.
So that's a really interesting part, right? Because the whole point of connections reform is to move faster, get stuff onto the system, bring costs down for consumers. And yet here we are kind of a long way in. And it almost seems like, yes, we're doing work around the technical assessments to make sure these projects are sort of fit for purpose, which is absolutely right. And on things like the portal, you know, you have to get these things right. You have to give people sort of fair opportunity to be able to compete. I suppose one of the things that seems really sort of odd to me is that I would say network operators and big sort of technical engineering type tasks take a long time to fix. And so when you tell me that you'll get the connection offer coming through in for, say, transmission in, say, January of 2026, but you're supposed to be building in 2026, like, these things take so much time to get ready. So how do you, as someone who wants to put hundreds of millions into these projects, how do you kind of keep that cash ready to go and hold your contractors as well to say, hey, trust us, this is coming, but actually you don't know.
No, and that is very difficult. And I think the whole purpose of protection was meant to be to give that confidence. But as I say, it's not quite there. And especially if you have an offer that might be flexible, non-firm initially, and then firmer later, you need to know what the firm picture looks like to see what your investment, you know, looks like overall. So there's a lot of live discussion at the moment as well about how we deal with those phased offers. We can't have everyone wait until the end of the year if they've got a connection next year. I think it's an open secret that a lot of the close-term protected projects are probably not deliverable with those dates now. Supply chain is a big issue. People, everyone sort of robs Peter to pay Paul, especially when it comes to commissioning engineers. And outages, system access as well. There is some reform reviews going on at the moment about allowing more outages to happen to connect projects. But at the end of the day, the grid is there to feed you and I and our house. That's the priority. So we've got to make sure that the lights stay on while we do this work. So yeah, it is a difficult question, I think, to see how we could deliver those near-term projects within that horizon.
Yeah. I think maybe there's two really interesting parts in that. And just to make sure we've kind of covered them. So connections being both fixed and also flexible. You talked about phased connection offers. What do you mean by that?
So there are a number of initiatives brought in recently, such as technical limits or active network management, which basically means the grid theoretically doesn't have enough capacity, doesn't have enough pipes for your electricity to flow. But given the intermittency of renewable generation, it doesn't make sense to size the network for this maximum exports that might happen a few hours of the year. So customers are being given options to connect earlier, but with an actively managed connection. So basically, when it sees like the limit's going to be reached, a signal will be sent to the generator to turn down, and that's called curtailment. And that will be a lost revenue or whatever on the balance sheet, but that might be acceptable because you get to connect earlier. In the meantime, the DNO might never actually do the upgrade works. It might be an enduring flexible connection, but at transmission, they have to do the works contractually. So they might still do those works to make it firm, but that might not happen for another 10 years. But you've got an opportunity to generate revenue for 10 years when otherwise you might have been waiting.
And for some assets like data centers, this is a really big issue. You know, you want that sort of five nines of reliability. You want the connection power to be there. For, say, batteries, it can be much more flexible. And if you say to a battery owner, by the way, you're going to lose 10 half hours in the year, they kind of go, well, maybe that's not an issue.
Or, yes, you can plan around it.
You can't export in the middle of summer. You go, well, I didn't really want to anyway, so that's fine. That's no problem. I suppose the other thing you also mentioned, and it's really interesting, and maybe we'll kind of come back onto it in the wider conversation, is to do all of these upgrade works, you have to take parts of the network off in order to do that. And I think there's really sort of interesting story that's going on within GB at the moment, but also globally. When you want to build out more grid connections than ever before to connect things like wind, you also are having to do these large reinforcement works, which means you have to take stuff off the system. And so you get sort of this sort of double impact coming through on things like constraints.
Correct.
And so I think it's just a really interesting piece. I think if you can take a step back from it, maybe some of the constraints piece will ease as both the new connections come online and also the outages in terms of putting through those new connections also ease. Is that sort of a fair way of describing it? Or
Yeah, I think as there's more, you know, copper in the ground and whatnot, there's more diverse routes for the power to flow. So that might help mitigate some of this. The sort of the standard that governs security of supply hasn't been reviewed in a while. I know it's probably not a very popular opinion to have after, say, Heathrow, that we need to look at that. But I think we do. And there's a very high level of resilience given to certain group demands, which isn't always needed by single customers like a data center. Yeah, and in terms of the constraint payment piece, I mean, it's quite a big topic at the moment, isn't it? And we see that constraint payments are higher than they ordinarily may have been because of the outages on the system in that sort of England-Scotland interconnector. And I think that's an interesting piece as well. It sort of exemplifies how we're very good at pulling on different bits of the energy system and not necessarily thinking about how that ripple affects the other corner of it. You know, incentivizing more wind to be built in Scotland sort of doesn't make much sense until we have that transmission capacity, which we, you know, we should have started doing 15 years ago, but we haven't. And we're still talking about needs cases and all that. And I think now those two bootstrap interconnectors coming on the offshore are now going to go ahead. But, you know, we're not going to see the benefits of those till the mid-2030s.
Yeah. And when you say bootstrap interconnectors, you essentially mean large cables that run down the side of the country.
Yeah, in the sea, basically. I saw this morning Scottish Power Transmission have just launched their consultation on the one between, I'm not going to know the substations off the top of my head, but down the west coast of Scotland, essentially.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
Going back to the topic of connections reform, we might go from what from the outside maybe looks a little bit like a snail's pace to all of a sudden having this kind of tidal wave of projects coming through and coming online.
Yeah.
How are we going to work around that?
So, yeah, I think resource planning is key. I think the networks need to be honest about how many people they need to deliver this. I think they also need to look more at automation where they can in terms of the studies and offer process. A lot of that is still very manual. If I was to make a good investment, I would suggest we need to build some factories in this country to build transformers and cables because, you know, we join the queue with the rest of Europe most of the time.
And I'm picking up on that factory point. Also, it's the qualified engineers who can then deliver these projects as well, right? Because there's only a finite resource of sort of appropriate commissioning engineers who can go on site and can get these sites online.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of them, you know, go as independent contractors, and then not all of the networks allow those people to then come back and work for them. So I think there's a whole workforce planning piece. I mean, I'm pleased to see the government has sort of launched their green job strategy. I haven't looked at it, so I don't know what the detail is, but I think that's the sort of thing we need to certainly be looking at. Also, I think we've now moved to a much more, or we're moving to a much more sort of, you know, centrally planned system, which I think is probably required given the sort of the near-term targets that we have, and also much more open and transparent system. It was very much about, you know, commercial confidentiality. You can't speak about other people's projects. We're now seeing a big push towards more data being provided. You know, they still can't publish the whole queue because of a certain clause in the Electricity Act called Section 105, but I've not met a single developer that would be against changing that. Okay. And having that transparency could allow developers to come together as consortia and make better use of the physical connection assets. It's not just electrical capacity, it's physical space. You know, a 400 kV bay could service up to a gigawatt. It makes no sense having a 200 megawatt BESS sitting in that bay, maybe even 2 gigawatts. So what we need to do is have developers to come together to share those bays. So there is some work going on bay sharing.
People always talk about bays. I'm not sure everyone actually knows what a bay is.
Okay.
How would you, to someone on the street, how would you describe a bay?
So it's basically a plug.
Okay. And is it the size of sort of a mouse, a bus?
A plug socket. It would be taller than you.
Okay.
probably about as wide as this table, perhaps, depending if it's air insulated or gas insulated. But essentially, in the substation, you have a big lump of copper called a bus bar, and that takes the electricity from the circuits, the cables that are around. And then to connect onto that bus bar, you put a circuit breaker on there, and that's essentially a plug that you can plug your cable into.
Okay.
And the way at transmission, at least, I mean, at distribution, there's a lot more socialization of connections happens, and IDNOs are a great example of that. We've got a number of projects where we have a customer with, you know, three or four projects at the same substation. We approach a DNO and say, you don't want to give up four bays. You know, they're at a premium. Let us just socialize it into one under an IDNO. Great. At transmission, it's a bit different. National Grid will not own anything, in England and Wales at least, will not own anything downstream of their substation. So that cable, that transformer, all has to be privately owned by the developer. So you're basically going to have lots of developers trying to get lots of cable routes into one substation. Mm. This is sort of why we've set up Eclipse Power Optimized, because we think that's really inefficient. Why not have a grid co that can own those assets, fund those assets, and connect multiple customers? And ideally, you also co-locate some demand on there as well, and you keep that flow within the private network.
And this is kind of that trend, private wires, right? So we're seeing sort of many more of these coming through. How would you describe a private wire system to someone? And as a follow-up question on private wires, like how big can these be? Because is it sort of like a private wire on someone's house, so it's a solar panel and a battery? Yeah. Or is it a private wire like this is a whole estate all just sitting behind sort of 1 meter point and it's potentially kilometers of private wire?
Yeah, both. So you've kind of got your traditional private wire, if you like, which is a single customer and a generator. So, you know, a large industrial user, they might not like the fact that their energy bills are quite high. So they want to put some solar on the roof or a ground mount solar next door or a battery or whatever. And that would just feed that one customer. And there'd be a power purchase agreement between the owner of the generation and the customer, and maybe some export to the grid as well via their connection.
And crucially, all of that's sort of behind one meter.
Behind
right?
one meter,
so,
correct.
So there's kind of that whole business case is happening almost without grid's knowledge.
Well, you have to let the grid know, because there can be an impact on the grid if there's a fault. Mm. But yeah, otherwise it's fine. There become issues and challenges where you start to try and connect to multiple customers behind the meter, because you can't do what's called run in parallel behind the meter, i.e. export to 2 meter points at once, because the DNO doesn't have visibility of what those power flows are doing, which makes sense.
So how big can this actually be? What's sort of the biggest private wire that you've seen and worked on?
So we're working at the moment on Future Point Manchester, which is 1.4 gigawatts, up in the northwest of England, a JV with Carlton Power.
Okay.
So there is a they're funding and building an OCGT. There's going to be some battery, and there's also going to be a data center that's currently being marketed at the moment. In that scenario, we're coming off National Grid's 400 kV system. So this is where it becomes a bit more complicated. So traditionally, generators have been allowed to own what National Grid call high voltage assets. So 400, 275 kV, the supergrid, the motorway voltages. Generators can own those assets because they're not counted as part of the main transmission system. Once you start looking at demand-only connections, or connections less so with hybrid connections, but demand connections, that's considered part of the transmission system. And the current legal view under the Electricity Act 1989 is that that's a licensable activity. You need a transmission license. So National Grid will give you a connection at 132 kV. So that means you need to wait for them to build a new grid supply point or a new supergrid transformer, which is the size of a house and costs £15 million and can take years. And they might not necessarily build that until there's enough customers to make it worthwhile. So you're in a scenario now where demand customers are disadvantaged. And when the government is saying we need 500 megawatt AI growth zones, it makes no engineering sense to feed 500 megawatts at 132 kV. That's a lot of cable and a lot of land take. So we don't think that was the right approach. So as I say, we did apply for a transmission license. Ofgem won't grant one. So where do we go from here? So we're hoping to be a license exempt network. And if that happens, then that'll be an industry first, and that'll be huge. So we'd be then looking at 400 kV, stepping down to 132 fairly swiftly. We can have demand and generation, you know, next to each other on the same site or whatever, fed by that private network. There's less power goes through that boundary meter. So you pay lower grid charges, lower, you know, commodity prices as well. And also it potentially provides a route to market for generators that might be unsuccessful in gate two, but they have a good site that's still got land agreements or whatever.
Yeah.
So we think it's really exciting. Then the other end of the scale, the first site that we've energized recently is a sub 1 megawatt residential development in, I want to say Norfolk,
okay.
if I'm not 100% sure, Essex, yeah, near Epping. And that's in conjunction with Octopus. It's what they call zero bills development. So there's solar, battery, and a smaller grid connection. Mm-hmm. And that's all just consumed on site in the microgrid. And the people that live there have no energy bills for 5 years guaranteed.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting.
I think we're going to see a huge amount of that, right? And in some sense, it's a bit of a challenge to the grid. Like that people can put solar and batteries on their own site, or people can go down the private wire route, is almost a challenge to the grid and say, hey, look, you need to get this to the point where it is a low enough cost that it competes with people doing it themselves on their own systems. If people can build their own version of this for less money than you're offering it,
yeah,
given all the advantages you already have, it's a real challenge, I think.
It is. There is one regulatory hurdle, though.
Okay.
Another one. Again, under the Electricity Act 1989, to supply domestic customers an aggregated load of over 1 megawatt, you need a distribution license. So you need to be an IDNO. Mm-hmm. So that means that everyone would then have a boundary meter to the grid. So we have to keep below that 1 megawatt threshold. But we think there's a case to lobby to lift that threshold.
Again, I think just perhaps as a side note to all of this conversation, just understanding how much of the energy industry sort of the engineering and technical performance that's possible also has to meet so much of the regulatory sort of hurdle. And the combination of lots of the business cases that you see coming through are those that are well positioned, both from a regulatory point of view, but also from a technical and engineering point of view.
Correct.
Fascinating kind of intermeshing of
commercial
those.
Commercial engineering, yeah. And also, you've got to, anyone connected to those private networks has still got to have the right to be able to appoint their own supplier and all that sort of stuff, which is now possible under the metering codes, which is really good.
Nice. Okay, very nice plug for that site, and we'll definitely put in a link if people want to check it out. So now, just going back to connections reform, so you must work with a lot of clients looking at connections reform. What advice would you give to clients to deliver sites well through the next couple of years?
Yeah, so make sure you stay on top of your gate two readiness. So make sure your land agreements stay up to date. I think, you know, as and when the gate two offers come out, make sure that you scrutinize them properly. Make sure you understand the costs that are in there, any potential outage or curtailment risk, because it's quite often that people sign up to where people interchangeably use firm and non-firm, an offer that is only connected by a single circuit. So if that failed, you're off basically. Or if there's other outages on the grid, the DNO might turn you off. That's non-firm in the kind of the traditional sense. All generation connections are of that ilk. So there could be quite high outage or curtailment risks. If you don't fully understand that, you might be signing up to something where you're off 40% of the year and you've got no right of recourse to the DNO because it's in your contract.
Yeah.
So understand that.
Well, let's talk about that, right? So sorry, I think if we just say, oh, by the way, you might have 40% outage, I think a lot of people are, oh, Christ, that's a real problem. Mm. So what does the distribution of outages look like? Is it common for someone to have a potential for 40% outage, or is that more like the exception?
It's probably uncommon, I would say. But in this scenario, it was in South Wales, connecting into one grid group, so one GSP group, GSP grid supply point is interface between the motorways and the local roads. And there was a 132 kV interconnector connecting to another grid group. Mm-hmm. Interconnectors, your ear should always prick up and go, ooh, because they can be run abnormally. So they might be switched out or over, so the power flow goes the other way. And then that's an abnormal running arrangement. So your contract normally means you have to be tripped off under those arrangements. In this particular site, it would have been, 40% of the year in the summer. They often backfed the interconnector to support demand in another part of Wales when there was maintenance elsewhere. And it just became unbankable. You know, I've also seen other customers where they've got connections from part of the grid and they think it looks fine, but then National Grid might decide to do some works, which causes the DNO to have to turn them off for a high percentage of the year. So yeah, it's really worth understanding your position in the network and also how reliable that network has been historically, and also what's planned for future.
And like I deal more in sort of the commercial world. So if I was to look, say, between an asset owner and an optimizer, they might agree a floor or a toll or some way of kind of ensuring returns to make sure those returns always come in and the revenues are delivered. I think one of the things that you're highlighting, which is, I think, people will find challenging, is almost the riskiness of that, and it's non-recourse. So if you get turned off or you get told you're not allowed to run, it's not like you get that large compensation payment coming through from National Grid, right? Depends which terms you've signed up to. So
exactly.
Do you ever see people sort of looking for insurance around those types of products, or is this just a risk that you have to do or assess through technical assessments?
Yeah, it's typically something I've seen people want to understand to bake into their financial models more than anything. So you've got your normal sort of curtailment, which is where you get turned down because of the issues on the grid, and then your straight up outage. The straight up outage is usually less visible, actually, and you have to dig around a little bit more. But yeah, I've not seen people trying to take out insurances from it. The other option is, you know, not the option, other option, but the sort of the difference is a distribution connection. You don't actually have a right to use a connection. The DNO can turn you off if it's in your contract. Transmission, when you've got transmission entry capacity, tech, that's actually a right to export onto a transmission system. So that's why you can be eligible for constraint payments if you are turned off to manage network constraints. And again, maybe that's something we need to look at because that's not changed since about 2001 or something, but yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so moving on from the constraint side, I just want to get your assessment of, we want to move very quickly in CP30, Clean Power 2030. It feels a little bit like Clean Power 2030 has had a sort of, a check has come in over the last few months, as it were, to the speed that we're going to deliver it. And I don't think many people in the industry necessarily thought that Clean Power 2030 was really deliverable, but saw it as almost like a worthy goal, is perhaps with the way I'd phrase it. Just in terms of the speed that we want to move at, so we've got something like 27 gigawatts of batteries that we want to do by, somewhere between 22 and 27 gigawatts by 2030. Do you think that we can actually move at that speed in terms of the engineering ability that we have to connect projects?
I think it is very challenging. I think for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, there will be bottlenecks within that. I think the DNOs and the TOs, transmission owners, and NESO, the system operator, are looking at, you know, what date is realistic when these gate two offers come out, which is important. You know, having a gate two offer is a privileged position in the queue. I don't think there'll be, and it's probably another warning to developers, I don't think there'll be any leeway for faffing around, basically. The ENA have brought new milestones in, which are challenging. I think 2 months to get planning is has always been maybe not fit for purpose. There is some flexibility in that, but you know, you'll be held to account and you'll be made to move. If not, you're gone because someone else wants that place in the queue. I think Clean Power 30 has always been a very laudable goal. I got into this industry for fear of, you know, seeing the climate change, seeing biodiversity loss. You know, that's what motivates me in my job, and that's why I do what I do. And I think we've kicked the can down the road for far too long. We've known about global warming since the 80s. It's always been, oh, we'll deal with it in 10, 15 years. Oh, you know, we'll keep using gas for another 10 or 15 years, you know. And that narrative is perpetuated. I think having a hard target to focus the mind has been so important. And I would really, really warn against backtracking on that. But if it means that we slip into 2022, 2033, 2034, that's fine. But at least it's not pushing out to 2040, which causes more people to drag their feet.
Yes. Yeah. I think actually when all's said and done and someone reflects on it in the 2030s, they might look back at CP 2030 if they so choose to. And they all think that actually that the sort of aggression of the goal was very useful for holding sort of industry's feet to the fire and just working out how fast we can move, noting that a lot of these things are very slow.
Yes. And I think it's a case of ensuring the supply chain is there to deliver. And I think there is, the supply chain is there in the world. It's things that people are willing to use and approve. And again, plug for IDNOs, I suppose. We can be more flexible if, you know, if you want to look at a transformer manufacturer in China that can get you a transformer in 12 months, and yeah, we'll take an engineering view on it. Whereas trying to get that through, say, National Grid, you might be stuck in 18, 24 months of design approval, and then by which time you might as well join the queue at Siemens.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so then I just want to talk about one other element of the grid and potentially moving faster. So a lot of what we've been talking about at the moment has been new connections. But one thing that we see other grids looking at is this potential to sort of revise what's already on site. So can we make more from, or can we do more with our existing solar park? Can we do more with the connections we already have? What's your take on that? And how easy is it to actually modify some of these connections?
That's a really, really interesting point. I think there's sort of two sides to it. There's the first bit is looking at the existing fleet. A lot of it's probably underperforming. I used to work at a solar developer. They did an exercise where they looked at their existing portfolio, and I think they managed to eke out another 50 megawatts of generation out of it just by making performance improvements. There's also shed loads of unused capacity sitting in connection agreements. We see that as an IDNO, people get 2 MVA import. They never use more than one, but contractually that's theirs. I think we need to look at more mechanisms to claw that back from people or buy it back from people. Perhaps more rightly. And then in terms of retrofitting the existing connection, exactly, we need to do more of that. It's using existing assets. You know, the capacity factor of solar is 14%. Those assets are really underutilized. It becomes challenging because we have allowable change guidance. So you can't just change your technology or add new technology and expect to keep your place in the queue, which is fair, I think.
So what does that mean? So if you change your tech when you're in the queue, you're to the back of the queue, does that always happen?
Yeah.
What about if it's a minor change? So if I just go from, say, 10 megawatts to 11 megawatts, do I go to the back of the queue?
Yep. So you can't increase. You can always decrease.
Okay.
You could maybe increase and get that extra megawatt as a phase two with its own queue position. But what you can't do is basically, wholesale change the current queue position you've got. What you could do is do some technical assessment around it and go, right, my current contract gives me this much export, this much fault level headroom. This is the behavior on the grid. If you can do some studies to prove to the DNO that what you're going to change to doesn't impact that, then usually that can be okay. Because the overarching principles of the it is guidance is always fairness to others in the queue, detrimental impact to other customers.
Okay.
And the big popular topic at the moment is, can I put a data center on my battery site, or can I turn my battery site to a data center? Did a lot of work on this. Answer is not really. There was a lot of work done over the last couple of years by the networks to change battery modeling assumptions, change battery security of supply standards to get more batteries on the grid, which gave people quicker connections. And now people are asking to turn them back to what's called final demand, because that demand is not used back onto the grid. As I say, maybe we need to look at the security of supply standards again, but NESO did come out and say that's not an allowable change. That demand element will go to the back of the queue.
I mean, it is such a big change, right? Batteries are, although they're active nearly all of the time, the actual sort of load factor is very low on a battery site.
Yeah.
Typically cycling, 1 to 2 times a day. Your data centers want that 5.9's availability. Their usage might be something like 60, 70, 80%, but they are fundamentally very, very different assets.
They are, and I don't think anyone really knows how they operate yet fully. I mean, UKPN have put some interesting data on the data centers on their network now, and none of them using their full capacity. Here, they're just modeled as a flat demand. I understand in Germany, there actually are some more sort of load profiles and curves and things like that, because if you're training for AI or whatever, it can be quite choppy. If it's just cloud, maybe it's a bit flatter. But it's an interesting point. But I think we do need to find a way to make it work. And again, it's if the technical parameters are the same, it should be allowed, because at the moment we're just going to, these companies are going to go and invest elsewhere if we don't find a way through on that. But and I think people also need to be aware that, strictly speaking, if you put demand, even if it's behind a meter, final demand on your connection, you become liable for the residual element of tenuos, which is significant, or going to get more significant.
Okay. Super interesting. And maybe I'll just give you one final question on connections reform, which is that if you kind of have the magic wand, as it were, and you get to fix an element of it, you get to change it to be your view, like what do you want it to look like?
Got two points on this, I think. So the first one is, there's such a easy thing we could do right now is to issue all the offers that were already not dependent on transmission works. I don't think NESO realized truly how much stuff was actually still sitting in the queue that could have already just connected yesterday. I remember when I first started doing this job, you could ring up the DNO, get a surgery, get a grid offer, no transmission assessment, you could connect your 50 megawatts tomorrow if you were ready. And there is still projects in the queue like that. They could be given their gate to offers now. There's going to be no change to those. That would be a really, really quick win.
But your earlier point, is that fair, right? So you were saying kind of all things in the grid queue, provided it's fair to everyone else in the queue. If you just bump someone up from position 300, right, because they could be added with very little work, is that fair?
So not bumping people up the queue. And again, these projects probably should have moved anyway. But the phase one, so out to 2030, the sort of the original queue position is basically maintained in a relative position. So that wouldn't be bumping anyone up the queue, but it would be giving those investors certainty they've got a grid offer that will pass their tech DD to then connect. Additionally, I've been banging on for about 2 years that we need to have included embedded demand in this, which is demand connected to the local DNO networks, so the likes of a new hospital or housing estate. I get why it wasn't included, because you don't want to hold those up, but at the moment there are increasing numbers of small demand connections that are now waiting behind transmission works. If you make an application now and the DNO needs to then apply to NESO for the transmission assessment, you'll be assessed against the existing contracted background, which is the mess, as we know, and you'll get a date of 2037 or whenever. The ENA is now finally looking at this, but we need to see a concerted approach of A, how can customers apply to benefit from the new queue, and B, how is the existing queue going to be reassessed? Because initially it wasn't proposed to be, but at the end of the day, the grid is there to feed embedded demand customers. If they end up disadvantaged out of all of this, I think the whole thing is...
Exactly. Two things on this. So the first thing is, the grid is absolutely desperate for demand, both in terms of reducing negative prices on the system, but also being able to average out FIT, RO, CFD, CM costs. That's a whole bunch of acronyms I've just dropped in, which I didn't mean to, but all of the costs which go to essentially fixed costs for running the system, essentially all of those being aggregated over more demand will help to lower bills. So
that's a really good point.
That's one sort of part. But the second part I want to say, ENA, you kind of snuck that in.
Sorry.
Who are the ENA?
Electricity Networks Associations. They're a trade body for all of the electricity network companies, basically.
Okay. Okay, very good. I think we've covered a whole range of things around networks, and I think it's been sort of fascinating oversight. I do have two final questions, but before I go to those two, I just wanted to ask, you mentioned UKPN, who are a DNO and also a DSO, so they're a network operator and a system operator.
Yep.
You're an independent network operator, so IDNO. Do you see eye to eye with the network operators, or is there sort of warfare between the two?
I think we challenge each other. I mean, a lot of my work over the last couple of years has been working with the DNOs to get better policies in place to allow IDNOs to play at the higher voltages, because IDNOs I'm going to use another acronym, EHV, extra high voltage, so your 33,000 volts and above, was pretty new. So now we've got some more policies in place, which helps. I think it took a bit of time for some of them to realize we are another licensed entity, not just another customer. But yeah, I mean, we're in competition with each other, but we work together on things. And Eclipse is actually a member of the ENA as well as the INA, which is the Independent Networks Association. So yeah,
God, we've done all the acronyms. This might be a record episode for acronyms, and I hope people have sort of stayed with us on
give
on
you
that.
A glossary if you want.
Yeah, we can definitely definitely get a glossary in there. Okay, my two final questions. So firstly, is there anything you'd like to plug?
I think it's the socialization of grid connections point, particularly at transmission. I think we need to see a lot more of that. I think we need to see more competition at transmission. I don't necessarily advocate in splitting up of the monopoly businesses. I don't even necessarily advocate them being in private hands. But I think for single customer last mile connections, competition has proven to be a success at distribution, and we need to see that at transmission as well.
Okay, I really like that. And then what is a contrarian view that you hold?
I think at the moment, as a number of them, I had to pick one, I think the industry at the moment is facing a potentially existential crisis based on certain political parties, you know, withdrawing support for net zero on the grounds of that it's too expensive. And I think the industry is doing a really bad job of controlling that narrative. At the moment, we're seeing the government going, more renewables will bring down the cost of energy. I mean, it will bring down the wholesale price, and we're seeing that. However, they've also shelved market reform, so we're still having gas lead the price. But additionally, that's kind of disingenuous when the levies on bills, you know, there's a new nuclear levy coming in, it's 1st of November, I think it was, and network charges, the tenuous demand element in particular, going up 94% for some EHV users, because we're paying for 15 years worth of missed investment in, you know, 5 years. All of those are going up, and they're going to keep putting upward pressure on bills in the short and medium term. And I think the government needs to be honest with people about that. And we need to look radically at moving some of these levies either into general taxation, if we're deeming that now a clean power grid is a public good, or moving some of them onto the gas bill. Because, you know, I was looking, I unfortunately burn gas for my heating. I was looking at getting a heat pump and things like that. And at the moment, you know, while the cost of gas is cheap, I know heat pumps are more efficient, but while the cost of gas is cheaper per unit than electricity, that incentive is less prevalent for people that are maybe just looking at the economics of this stuff. So
yeah, I totally agree. And that sort of gas to energy, sorry, that gas to electricity split, it's around four times more expensive for electricity.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so even if your heat pump is four times more efficient to generate heat, then it still kind of comes out around the same. I've been doing the same calculations.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, it really only works if you have, say, solar panels on your roof, and you can kind of do a little bit of the private wire type system that we talked about earlier. But really, that structural design of how much gas costs, how much electricity costs, has to be fixed if we're going to try and encourage more demand to come onto the system, which allows us to socialize those costs more widely. So
totally agree.
I hope government is hearing that message, and it's really interesting to see it from the network charge element as well, as well as the sort of the levy side, which I see on a more regular basis.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's business users as well. I mean, business users at the moment are crying out for cheaper energy, but again, their energy is going to keep going up. And if we're serious about kickstarting the economy, high energy costs is a drag on all of it. So I think it needs some bravery put to it. You know, we Clean Power 30, connections reform, strategic spatial energy plan that's going to be the successor to Clean Power 30 that will look at spatially where do we put energy, also in terms of the grid for the next, you know, however many years, is really radical and really important and really something to be celebrated, actually, what we've done and how far we've come in and what is a relatively short period of time. We need that sort of thinking to be applied to the supply side as well, I think.
I agree. Charles, thank you for coming on Transmission. You've been a wonderful guest. We could have gone on
very welcome.
We could have gone on for hours, so let's wrap it up there.
Thank you. Thanks so much.